Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with co-host Chase Palmieri. On today's Project Censored Show, this is our maiden voyage for videoing the program, so you won't only be listening to the program, you'll also get to watch online. You can learn more at projectcensored.org. On today's program, we are joined by Dr. Nolan Higdon. He is a lecturer at California State University in History and Media Studies. He is a longtime contributor to Project Censored and co-host of the Along the Line podcast. He's also co-author of a forthcoming book that was co-authored by me, United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. That's basically the theme for today's program, accompanying an article that Nolan Higdon has recently published with the Journal of Critical Thought and Praxis. Today's theme, Rallying Over Balloting, The Origins of Millennial Activism. Stay with us.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we welcome back Nolan Higdon. Of course, Nolan is no stranger to the Project Censored audience. Nolan Higdon also is co-host of the Along the Line podcast that is sponsored by Project Censored and the Media Freedom Foundation. You can learn more about that at projectcensored.org. And I'm sure that Nolan will also be talking to us about the many other things that he has afoot. Today, real quick, just want to give a proper introduction to Nolan. Dr. Nolan Higdon is a lecturer of history and media studies at California State University, East Bay. He sits on the boards of the Media Freedom Foundation, Action Coalition for Media Education, and Northwest Alliance for Alternative Media and Education. He's a founding member of the Global Critical Media Literacy Project at gcml.org and co-host, again, as I said, of the Along the Line podcast. Nolan Higdon also was a co-host for some time here at the Project Censored Show. Nolan Higdon, welcome back to the program.
It's great to hear from you guys.
So, Nolan, in addition to what we're going to talk about today, one of your fantastic pieces of research, an article recently published in the Journal of Critical Thought and Praxis, Rallying Over Balloting, The Origins of Millennial Activism. And I know for a long time you focused on youth activities, education, critical media literacy. Your dissertation dealt with some of those related issues. And of course, you and I just finished not long ago this book, The United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America and What We Can Do About It, which will be out later in August on City Lights Books. And you've also finished a manuscript on fake news that's getting picked up by a publisher. So you've been really busy doing a lot of work, teaching, publishing. I like the thought and praxis connection here because of all the young scholars, the millennial scholars that we know, you are becoming one of the most prolific here. And in addition to that, it is not just that you're doing the publishing and the writing and the research, you're also teaching and you're also an activist yourself and you're out in the community and you work a lot with students. So this article that you recently published, Rallying Over Balloting, The Origins of Millennial Activism, can you lay this out for our audience? What exactly are you looking at here?
I became somewhat frustrated with people always asking why millennials were not civically engaged. But then when I spent my time with millennials, they're totally civically engaged. And so I want to kind of look at why were some millennials participating in activist movements and why were others not? So what was the origin of these millennial movements? Because around me, I mean, everywhere you go, you can see youth activism, whether it be against gun violence in schools, combating climate change, Black Lives Matter, Occupy, the Me Too movement. Millennials are on the front lines of most of these movements. And so I want to see what were the origins? Why is it some millennials decide to participate and others do not? And I set up interviews, interviewed about 121 millennials, and created a scaffolding about who they are, what their experiences were, what kind of activism they had participated in. And then I tried to search what were the root causes of the activism and their participation. And so I found that there's really like five things in a person's background, a millennial's background, that lead to their activist participation: family, friends, institutions and organizations, encounters with activism, media and popular culture, and then this category called hate and harm, which meant exposure to hate and harm can be something that engenders millennial activism.
in terms of their peer groups, their personal experiences, the demographics that they're part of, that you're tying into their individual experience then on what might spur them to become active?
It can be a litany of things. So take like the family and friends category. I found some people, it was merely that their parents participated in activist movements and it brought them when they were younger and spurred their activism. Others, you know, they would get like projects in school. By the time they're maybe 15, 16 years old, they have some project where they have to interview a family member. They interview a family member about their past. The family member tells them that they participated in some activist movement and turned on the student's interest in doing activism themselves. Friends as well, same thing. A friend wants to participate in activist movement, bring somebody along. That person then becomes very active as well. And I found that activism is very intoxicating to millennials. Any sort of exposure to it or knowledge of it, and they want to participate.
It seems invigorating, and it's not a spectator sport, right?
Right.
So it's not something they're watching. It's something that they're actually part of. And I know you cover one of the themes that you cover, media and popular culture. So part of that invigoration is they are influenced by media. And of course, the work that we do at Project Censored and that you've done with us over the years at Project Censored, and especially news abuse and junk food news, we talk a lot about negative elements of news media, negative elements of what goes on. But in this study, you're talking about media and popular culture as kickstarting people's interest in this kind of work.
Yeah, this was one of the most fascinating, also one of the most controversial things I found. It's important to tell our audience, you don't want to be an absolute about media. It's not the greatest thing and everything about it's wonderful, but everything about it's not horrible either. What I found in my research was that especially social media and YouTube videos, those can be a gateway to get people active. So there's kind of this misconception that if we put an iPad in everyone's hand, they're all of a sudden going to be civically engaged. That's simply not true, and the evidence proves that. However, if while they're using these digital tools, they're able to see activism in real time or be exposed to activism in real time, it does spark their interest. That can be an initial step toward becoming active. It's not the end all be all, but it can be. And I saw this with things like Occupy or the anti-war movement against the war in Iraq, that people said online they would watch these marches, they'd watch these protests, they'd watch Black Lives Matter marches, and it inspired their interest to go out the streets themselves.
So Nolan, have you had a sense that the millennials tend to lean into the activism for policies or issues that they don't see the older generations actually making progress on?
Typically, yeah. But millennials are sort of retreading a lot of ground that was not taken care of in previous generations. I mean, we can think this month we're celebrating the 100 years of the federal recognition of women's right to vote, but we're still decades away from the ERA, right? The Equal Rights Amendment for Women. So those battles are still being hashed out today. I think what's different is, at least the last 40 years, the American public became rather complacent. There were clearly activists and people doing fine work in the United States, but millennials seem to be a little more confrontational on the ground. They're kind of willing to get out there. Where you see this most, I think, is undocumented immigrants. The previous generation of undocumented immigrants tended to err on the side of caution, hide in the shadows, try not to get exposed, et cetera. But the youthful generation of millennials, they're willing to go out in the streets and do this head on, their undocumented status. So millennials seem a lot more confrontational than I think we would have expected maybe 10 or 15 years ago from them.
That's pretty interesting, Nolan Higdon, because again, you know, if you watch corporate media and you listen to the two major corporate parties, Republicans and Democrats, one of the narratives that we heard coming out of the last election was that millennials, while becoming this large voting bloc, in fact, the largest voting bloc post-baby boomer, they're not tuned into politics and they're apathetic and millennials don't care about what's happening and they're lazy and they're living with their parents. And you're familiar with the narratives. You and I have written about this and spoken about this quite a bit. And again, my experience mirrors yours and actually what you're finding in this study, that I find that this is a very dedicated and activist group. And you're giving us five factors in your study, rallying over balloting, the origins of millennial activism. You're analyzing that with your sample size. So I wanted to get to that, the sample size. So can you talk to people a little bit about how you went about this and some of the things that you asked to give people a taste for, you know, how you discovered some of the things that you did? And then we'll get more into those.
I went to a couple of activist events. One was for education. Another one was a march for climate justice. And I started pulling millennials aside and asking if they would do interviews. And so these 121 millennials had all participated in some form of activism. And then I just kind of asked them a series of questions about their background, how they were raised, about their schooling, about their parenting and their home life, and then started framing questions about what issues do they care about? What are they doing about those issues? And that's how I triangulated the different questions to figure out where did the origins of their activism derive. The interviews went on. I transcribed the interviews, and I looked through the interviews, and I tried to find similarities across the board. So not one of these categories derives from one single person. These come across the board. In particular, something we were talking about there a moment ago about people believing millennials are not civically engaged. One really unique thing, and this is the one thing I hope anybody takes who reads this study, is one of my findings about hate and harm. Millennials are seem to be motivated by something different than any generation we can see in our history. You know, there's been economic factors, there's been identity factors, there's been Cold War factors, whether you're a capitalist or a communist ideology, etc. Millennials seem to be motivated by hate and harm. And I'm not the first person to find this. Kristen Solstice Anderson, who's a millennial Republican pollster, she found this by doing polling data. I found it through doing qualitative data, but we both drew the same conclusion that when millennials encounter some sort of policy or problem, their first gut reaction is not like the economic implications or the ideological implications. They're like, who gets hurt? Who's going to get harm? Like, what's the harm in this policy? And so they're more interested in framing these things and like, how do we avoid hurting others? How do we avoid trying to harm others? That's the way millennials generally approach these. That doesn't really fit well into sort of our left-right Democrat versus Republican political discourses. And so I think that's why people mistakenly think millennials are checked out, but I think they're just asking different questions.
So Nolan, you're saying that, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're saying that the millennial generation is looking to see what the impact of the policy is, not necessarily the economic policy, but what group of people are being hurt or will be hurt if the policies don't change?
Yeah, like perhaps a policy on, let's say, I don't know, tax reform or something, right? And you'd have a liberal ideology that believes the government using that money to redistribute and invest would be a better way to use funds. And a conservative viewpoint would say, no, we want less government. We don't want them taking the money. A millennial would just say, like, well, what's the harm in doing it? What's the harm in not doing it? You know, what's the benefit for who and how? And so that it's just a different question. It's not necessarily so ideologically connected to a particular policy.
So it's a different metric that motivates them to seek out change. So they're asking different questions, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and this is why Donald Trump is kind of a really interesting figure for this time and place, because Donald Trump has a long public history of causing hate and harm. At the same time, you have this huge group of millennials, which are now about to be the biggest part of the voting bloc in 2020. And it's almost like a head-on collision between these totally different approaches to government and United States culture in 2020.
It's interesting that harm reduction is involved here, because in your study here, you talk a lot about the Columbine high school shooting and then the recent March for Your Lives protests. I'm wondering if you can explain that or tie that in, or maybe even more so explain why we didn't see the generation of the Columbine students activate in the way that we're seeing them now.
That's a good question. As far as the post-Columbine activism, I would say that these things do take time. I can remember being in high school myself during Columbine, and we didn't know what we were about to find out, which is this would become a common occurrence. Like if you pulled most people, myself included, and asked me to name all the mass shootings in the last 20 years, I think I would probably fail. I don't think I could name them all.
I can't even keep up this year, I'm sad to say.
Yeah, so it's become so out of control at this point. I think that's why you're seeing the fed up activism by the youth of like, how can you not deal with this previously? But the school shooting is a perfect example, your question on it, that a constitutional conservative point of view would try and argue that solving this problem by going after guns is an attack on the Second Amendment or something like that. And you know, maybe a more liberal perspective would say that it's best to handle these guns and get them out. But millennials' perspective, like, well, what's the harm in people having less access to guns or giving up guns? What's the potential benefit of not having them in the schools? So it's not as ideologically driven. It's questioning about kind of the hate and harm of the individuals involved.
And it also gets back into what you stated earlier about the millennials having firsthand experience with this harm, because as we see with the March for Your Lives students, it's literally the students that were at that school that then turn around and start this movement.
Yeah, it was a pretty inspiring display. And for folks who have went to school pre-Columbine, You know, I can remember in grad school, we were in a grad meeting and all of a sudden the fire alarm went off and every student in the class like freaked out and they were checking out the door and they're wondering if it was a school shooting. That's what kids bring with them to school nowadays. That's their experience. And I think the older you get into your teens and your 20s, you just become more and more fed up. It's not, nothing's being done about it. So to your question earlier about why there's not, hasn't been much after Columbine, I think the anger level is at an all-time high and frustration level with the lack of action in the face of gun violence.
Well, I'd like to remind listeners that you are tuned to the Project Censored show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with my co-host, Chase Palmieri. We are speaking with Dr. Nolan Higdon. He's a lecturer of history and media studies at California State University East Bay, and he's also a longtime board member of the Media Freedom Foundation and has worked with us at Project Censored for a long time. He's also co-host of the Along the Line podcast, and we'll make sure we give out websites for that stuff later on, including a link to the article that we're now talking about. We're talking about an article that Nolan Higdon recently had published in the Journal of Critical Thought and Praxis. It's called Rallying Over Balloting: The Origins of Millennial Activism. We'll continue that conversation with Nolan Higdon after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. Special thanks to Dennis Murphy, our producer today. This is the first show that the Project Censored Show is having video. So we'll be trying to post our programs, more of them, if not all of them, online at YouTube and other places until we're also deplatformed and censored by the big tech companies. Because we certainly will be talking about that topic more. Our guest is Dr. Nolan Higdon. He's a lecturer of history and media studies at California State University. He is also co-author with me of The United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America and What We Can Do About It. This is out August 13th, I believe, from City Lights. And actually, there's a lot of stuff in the book here that dovetails with the things that we're talking about today. We're speaking about Dr. Higdon's recent article, Rallying Over Balloting, The Origins of Millennial Activism. It's published in the Journal of Critical Thought and Praxis. So, Nolan, can you give a link to the article, perhaps?
It's the Journal of Critical Thought and Praxis, mm-hmm. and it's through Iowa State University. So okay. If you go to Iowa State University and look up their Journal of Critical Thought and Praxis, that's the best way to access it.
I'll read it out here. I think it's lib.dr.iastate.edu, and you can go from there. But again, the article is Rallying Over Balloting, The Origins of Millennial Activism. So why don't we jump in there, Nolan Higdon? What do you mean by that title? What does that title mean to you in terms of how it encapsulates the study?
Well, it's really where the study started. In 2016, people were expecting that as millennials were growing in size and they were participating more in the streets, that it would actually turn into them showing up to vote more. But we actually saw a reduction in millennial voting in a lot of districts. And this has been the huge question. This remains the huge question going into 2020. What was it that turned millennials off in 2016? Because they were consistently growing voting for both of Barack Obama's presidential elections. But 2016 really turned them off. As most of our listeners know, these were the two least liked candidates in the history of polling data in an election. So this started with that is, what is the origins of this activism and why does it not turn into voting? What I've concluded is that I think our political parties for sure, and I would even argue our media and school systems, are not really responding to the things millennials are interested in. So I would reframe the question when people say, why are millennials not civically engaged? I would say kind of the way we define civic engagement doesn't include millennials.
That's pretty interesting observation, and also then something that educators in particular might be paying attention to in terms of pedagogy, critical pedagogy, and of course social justice pedagogy, given that you're talking about hate and harm as one of the five major motivators for millennial activism. We've certainly seen an uptick in social justice consciousness in this generation, and we are gradually, albeit maybe belatedly, we're certainly seeing a rise in social justice pedagogy. Is that also something that you're seeing?
Yeah, it's a big fight on campuses right now. You have definitely an undercurrent of social justice-minded educators and students who are trying to carve out these spaces on campuses and schools to introduce, you know, who's experiencing hate and harm and what are solutions for it. But that movement's buttressing up a very big corporatization movement that wants to turn our educational institutions into little schooling centers where they fill and drill them with information that can make them obedient workers. So yeah, the schools are quite a little controversial site at this point.
Indeed, and I know you worked at Diablo Valley College. You worked with me and several others on the social justice major that, again, it seemed like it took years to take off. But it is finally happening, and there is a social justice studies major. I know at Cal State East Bay, they're working on social justice issues in journalism. There is a concern, however, though, as social justice becomes sort of a curricular buzzword, where do you see your concerns in this case?
I think in some cases, it's already being co-opted as a way to, how can we sort of get people involved in the exploitative elements of capitalism, right? How can we get them in the job world to be equally exploited or take on more student loan debt? However, there are good educators out there who are trying to use these things to teach students not the value of collecting a paycheck, but the value of democracy. And so in the classroom, how do we teach people to go through the massive amount of information to best equip themselves to be equal participants in a democracy? And activism is a huge part of that. You hear about these protests, especially we live in the Bay Area, where they're like shutting down the freeway and stuff. And some angry commuter says, oh, what's protesting ever done? It's created like workplace safety. It's led to women's right to vote. It's led to the abolition of slavery. It's led to the Civil Rights Act. It's led to the 8-hour workday, the union movement, et cetera, et cetera.
Desegregation.
So, there's a lot of value there. So I think kind of reminding our students that and colleagues in these campuses that democracy is really what we're fighting for.
And so you would argue, you do in this article, you're arguing that millennials, once engaged, this becomes really a passion. We mentioned before, it's an invigorating thing. And of course, this is also the so-called digital generation or digital natives. And so, again, this comes, right, dual-edged sword. But it's also the case that the way that older generations organized and did things, they did them differently. And so the fact that millennials maybe do things differently, have different media, have different outlets, and also are asking different questions, do you think that this is also a reason why older generations sometimes don't see the activism of millennials or misinterpret it, as Chase said?
I think as I look at the older generation, especially at the anti-Vietnam movement and the younger generation, millennials, I do think there's a lot to learn from each other. These digital tools are great for connecting people, to turning you on to new issues, to learning new avenues for addressing those issues. But that old school organizing, the face-to-face organizing, getting people together in a common space to show in numbers, that still is the best way to organize and build your numbers based on every study we have. Christian Fuchs has done some great stuff on this. Social media can enhance a movement, but it rarely creates one. And I think that's a firm distinction for our listeners to understand. You can use social media to reach out and expand and get your message out and get more people in the streets, but it really doesn't turn into a movement without that base organization.
One example that popped to mind here is fourth wave feminism, which is based more on hacktivism and use of digital and social media. But it's based on the previous waves of feminism, based on generations of activism for women's rights. Julie Frechette wrote about this in the Censored book on the Me Too movement and Time's Up movement. And so that's kind of an example of where we see that melding of approaches generationally and also technologically. Do you see that as an example?
I think that'd be a prime example, because you have to also look at it from millennials' perspectives. They haven't seen what the folks saw in the 60s and 70s. They saw a massive outpouring of organization for a litany of different causes. Millennials really didn't see that. And at the same time, they were being instructed by corporations that, well, you can change the world if you just buy this tool and put it in your hand or set up this account. And so I think the issue with millennials, not they're lazy. I don't think they really understand some of that old school basic organizing. And social justice pedagogy can be a way to kind of introduce that to millennials and let them transform it in their own direction.
What are you seeing out of Generation X and how that relates to the millennials?
they're kind of seen as like an in-betweener. They're this half and half generation. They're corporate co-opted portion that a lot of millennials are fighting against, but they also are some of the roots of resistance that millennials popularize. You think of bands like Nirvana and things like that from Generation X. You think about Hollywood films at the time too, like movies like Reality Bites and their commentary on like corporate culture. So Generation X is kind of all over the place. They're tough to pin down, at least in my opinion.
Because to your previous point, it does seem that the ability to protest or at least to do it effectively seems to be passed down from generation to generation. Like if the millennials had maybe seen more firsthand activism from Generation X, perhaps the following generation would be more active. And I'm wondering then what you think will happen as far as the generation coming after the millennials.
What we saw from the shootings in Florida, it looks like these young folks are ready to continue this on after the millennials. So now kids in like middle school and high school probably saw some of these millennial movements like Black Lives Matter and Occupy, and they've been inspirational to them to move on to their movement. So I'm pretty optimistic about it in that state. But this gets back to that kind of question about the difference between old school and digital activism. Activism isn't just organizing people and getting them in one big space. You need to build an infrastructure so you can deal with resistance, especially resistance from the state, right? You think about like the firebombs and the dogs and things like that on civil rights protesters or Vietnam protesters. What Christian Fuchs and others have found, and not just in the United States, but around the world, that these digital organized protests tend to be pretty fragile because they don't have that infrastructure. And so that's, to me, the big question for millennials. How do you create a really strong infrastructure to deal with the increased state and corporate resistance to your organizing?
I'm not a spokesperson for Gen X. In fact, I think that that was kind of the joke going around there all over the place. I don't think Gen X has a spokesperson. That's why we're an X. But, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, Nolan Higdon. And I remember when you and I were in Washington, D.C., at the Breaking Through Power series of talks at Constitution Hall with Ralph Nader, and we were participating there. And again, this is absolutely nothing negative. This is not a criticism per se of Nader. But we noticed that there weren't a lot of younger people there, right?
Right.
There were definitely people there. As far as even the speakers went, there weren't a lot of younger speakers. I don't think there were a lot of millennial speakers. This was the interesting thing, because the younger people that were there ran over to the Project Censored table, right? And I remember then we were striking it up with them, and it wasn't that they weren't active, and it wasn't that they weren't involved, and it wasn't that they didn't want to do anything. It was that they were in a different paradigm. They were kind of in a different manifestation of activism that was a previous generation's way of expressing it and doing things about it. And I remember even in the talk that I was doing there, basically saying that I felt like I was in between groups. I knew people that were in their 70s and 80s that I had learned from and that were really important to me, forging my path. But then also, I've taught college 20 years, and once upon a time, a long time ago, you came through one of my classes, and that's how I met you. And so it's just a constant reminder of this conduit and this really important generational thread, this transgenerational thread, that I think that we really need to be connecting all of the elements that are working for each of the generation's activisms and what they've contributed. But how do we put it all together in one package, in one place? Do you have any suggestions? What are your thoughts on that?
I think you're absolutely correct. That's exactly how I remember that as well. I think one key thing that I notice at events is millennials in particular, they like to be talked with, not at. You've said that for a long time, and we know that as educators, but I would remind people of that. So if you're someone who has the privilege of going around to campuses or events and giving speeches, leave as much time as possible to take in questions and allow for dialogue back and forth. That's the kind of stuff millennials want. I don't think they're too big on celebrating heroes, giving speeches and things like that. And that dialogue, I think, can be really informative. When you listen to millennials, and millennials listen to a lot of these people who have veteran experience, you know, a lot of organizing experience, there's a lot to learn there, but you have to create some sort of dialogue. You can't just do it through osmosis.
Yeah, well, I want to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. Special thanks again today to our producer, audio and video, Dennis Murphy. We're now trying to video as many of the Project Censored shows as we can. Also, thanks, of course, to our senior producer, Anthony Fest, who glues everything together for us. After this break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Nolan Higdon. We are speaking about his recent article that's published at the Journal of Critical Thought and Praxis, Rallying Over Balloting, The Origins of Millennial Activism. Stay with us. Thank you. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we are rejoined by Dr. Nolan Higdon. He's a lecturer at California State University, East Bay. Also teaches with us at Diablo Valley College in History and Social Science. We're speaking with him about a recent article he did, Rallying Over Balloting, The Origins of Millennial Activism. Nolan also has recently completed a manuscript on Anatomy of Fake News, and we're also working on a film with Abby Martin. Also, Nolan and I had the pleasure of working with him on this. This book comes out in August. This book is called United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America and What We Can Do About It. In fact, today, Nolan Higdon, we're talking about one of the things that not just we can do about it, but that a generation of people are doing about it. You mentioned in your article, Rallying Over Balloting, The Origins of Millennial Activism, you mentioned that the election or selection or electoral college placement of Trump as president, Donald Trump as president of the United States, who lost popular vote. You mentioned that in your study as being something that maybe woke up, so to speak, some of the younger generation. Can you speak to that a little bit more?
Yeah, I think this idea that elections have consequences, I think, really woke people up with Donald Trump's election. Just things you wouldn't think about. I mean, the idea of ripping kids away from their parents at the border, for example, which was going on pre-Trump, but wasn't covered as much. That seems like a horrible plot in like some crappy B movie. But people are waking up and it's a real thing happening. Or the closing of abortion centers, it's a real thing happening. And I think it waking up people, there are serious consequences that come from elections. And so now millennials need to negotiate this space. How do they approach politics the way they have been approaching it while mitigating some of these things that we know they don't really like?
One of the things that I think is the least talked about in the political conversation, at least amongst corporate media today, is the idea that the millennials are the largest voting bloc going into the 2020 election. I'm curious, based on your research and what you're seeing in the classrooms, what are you expecting out of that voting bloc? Is it that we shouldn't expect them to turn out to vote again unless they have a candidate to vote for? Do you think that they're going to be showing up regardless this time?
Well, first, as I said, I think the media is not talking about this at all. You're absolutely correct on that. But the candidates are smart. They know it. I mean, that's why college tuition is the number one issue that all the progressive candidates are talking about. They want that youth vote. They need that youth vote, and they're trying to get it out there. As far as your question about what the millennials will do, millennials are a little fickle. Who knows? I mean, they turned out in big numbers for Obama twice. They seem to turn out in big numbers for Bernie Sanders. And when they felt they had been wronged by the system when it came to Hillary Clinton, they didn't turn out. After 4 years of Trump, will they do that again? If they get wronged again, I don't know. But right now, I think that's kind of the question is how does the Democratic Party approach millennials? It doesn't look like the Republicans are going to make any effort to try and capture the millennial vote. I could be wrong, but it doesn't appear so.
Which is interesting because another series of activist movements, the Uncoke My Campus, about the Koch brothers and a lot of right-wing billionaire money getting into campuses to try to skew and steer the mission of campuses, privatized, corporatized campuses. There is a conservative presence on campus, but I'm not entirely sure if the presence and voice is being escalated and elevated artificially because of the money behind it and the attention that it seems to get and the attention that then it drives in the media. Case in point, at UC Berkeley, there's a lot of media attention around protests and canceled speakers and censorship and so on. And from what we've seen by looking into these things, it's as if these moments are manufactured for the media circus to make it appear as though there are all these crises of free speech and crises on campus. Do you think that this is one of them? Because you've been talking to millennials, you've been doing research on millennial activism, and I know that you're talking a lot about social justice issues, but have you been encountering conservative activists in the millennial generation?
A small portion of the sample size actually were conservative activists. These are people who are inspired by what was going on campus and conservative ideology. But as far as the free speech on campus goes, listeners have to understand there's a new paradigm on campus. If you go back to the 1960s, especially in California, college is free. So these academics with tenure, they kind of ran the campus. They determined what was acceptable information and knowledge and who was an acceptable speaker, et cetera, et cetera. Everything's shifted now. Now you've got students who are spending 30, 60, 80 grand. They want to have a say in who's on their campus, what's going to be said.
The customer is always right.
Right. You've turned into a capitalist model. So it's odd to hear that these capitalists see young people sort of quote unquote voting with their dollar or wanting their dollar to go to the right place, and they attack them for doing this. But if I'm a liberal like UC Berkeley and I've spent about $100,000 on my undergraduate degree and you've got Milo there, you're taking my money to bring Milo on my campus, I think I might have a say. Whereas if it was free college, yeah, maybe it is up to the state to decide.
Those are interesting distinctions. It also brings me back to then one of the things that you bring out is that millennials have different ways of being politically active. And you even mentioned activist ways that were political and non-political. We could argue that everything is somehow political. But what did you mean technically when you were talking about that a little bit in the article in terms of things that millennials will do? Meaning that maybe it's not movement-based. Like, for example, you mentioned the film Super Size Me as being an example of an influencing documentary or something. So this may actually spur people to go and change the way they eat or change their own diets or change them amongst their peers, but they may not join some larger farm-to-table movement or agricultural, regenerative agriculture movement or something.
Yeah, there's these spaces that are seemingly not political. Like you said, watching Super Size Me, as a young person when I watched it, it didn't come off to me like I was participating in some grand like electoral college scheme, right? But it does change the mind. And then people become activists about food. Where does food come from? How should food be made? How should it be sold? So it comes from all these different spaces. But I think that's also an inspiring thing to folks. Maybe you don't necessarily want to be in the street every single weekend, but maybe you want to make a documentary. And that can have a huge impact. That can be a form of activism. Colin Kaepernick, his kneel down. I can't tell you how many millennials said they actually took to the streets because of Kaepernick. They were inspired by seeing this on television and they wanted to learn more about what they could do in their community. So these seemingly non-political, like in the electoral sense, actually have electoral impacts, influence.
Yeah, I couldn't help but think of Anthony Bourdain. Anniversary of his passing wasn't long ago. And one of the quips in the censored book in the junk chapter was it Michelle Wolf? The comedian who said, the only thing I get from CNN that I trust is when Anthony Bourdain tells me where to get noodles. And again, he was always talking about how food is so political. But I think that's just a great example. And you even mentioned yourself how you saw that at a younger age. I mean, even my kids, they're the ones that are going to be looking to millennials, right? They're the ones going to be looking at the millennial generation. And I can tell you that that's definitely a place where that they've really been turned on. I mean, because my 12 and 7-year-old have already seen Where to Invade Next, Michael Moore. They've seen Super Size Me. They've seen other documentaries on food with Michael Pollan. And they're totally turned on by it. They're really activated by this. And so I think that that's also, I'm really happy too that you were mentioning that and you were getting into that in the study, is because that's something that from the outside might be uncharted or that other people just don't see.
Yeah, because it's, again, it doesn't have to be sort of these quote unquote traditional ways, whatever that means, of activism. It can come from all these different sources. And if I could do a shameless plug, we wrote our book, United States of Distraction, together. I think it's a great sort of step-by-step guide of how the current situation came to being. And I think for millennials, it's really helpful because, I mean, I know this as well. I'm in my mid-30s, but I now lecture on 9/11 and the Bush era or the Clinton impeachment trial, and most students don't know, weren't alive, don't remember. So kind of contextualizing the era in which they're growing up, how did this come to be? And I think it helps explain what they're seeing around them, but also what they can do about it. Like, this didn't just happen overnight. There's a trend. There's a process here that took place. Let's understand that process so we can, one, never repeat it again, and two, hopefully solve some of the problems caused by it.
I want to point out one other interesting trend going on with millennials and what I would call digital activism, which is some of the memes that are going around the Andrew Yang campaign. Andrew Yang's campaign started out as a relatively unknown candidate, but his supporters are incredibly tech savvy and really understand the idea of a well-placed or well-crafted meme and how that can spread virally and almost make a candidate's cool factor and name recognition skyrocket. Have you been looking into what's going on with that campaign?
Yeah, I've been looking at that campaign for sure. And I mean, political communication, especially through these quote-unquote new tools, is having a massive impact. And I, again, sorry to do the shameless plug again, but I think in United States of Distraction, we talk about how it's not so much that Trump used the media necessarily, the media used the people, right? And Trump knew how to make that work to his advantage. Mm-hmm. And this is the new playing field. Again, to go back in time, Barack Obama really mastered the art of using email which sounds so antiquated for me to say that now, right? But Trump has really mastered social media. And so I think you're going to see Yang and others start to carve out their own space here for how they can sell their campaign. He's definitely finding success, though, through social media. And that goes back to what we were talking about with millennials being the biggest part of the voting bloc. You're going to have to figure out a way to get your message out through the digital sphere if you're planning on being a contender in this election and probably the ones to come.
Yeah, not only digitally, but Yang has also created his own version of the candidate hat, which says MATH, which stands for Make America Think Harder. But he definitely seems to be taking what he can from the Trump campaign's messaging success and reapplying it. And it's just very interesting to see how quickly a candidate in today's digital world can go from unknown to really competing on a big stage. And now many other candidates like that are going to be in the debates.
I agree. And this goes back to where we started in this interview that let's remind ourselves it's a double-edged sword. I mean, you could use it for good, right? You could use it to get your message out and captivate people and get a massive movement going on. But you could also use it for bad. And I think Trump sort of demonstrated that you could pull out the worst parts of our society and create the worst division and then capitalize upon it for your own political gain. Or perhaps the opposite again. Maybe you could bring people together, get people in the street, organize, et cetera. So it's a double-edged sword. I wouldn't be an absolutist about it.
Yeah, I think it's important to point out those nuances. And again, we do pull out some of that and discuss that in the United States of Distraction. And of course, listeners can check out City Lights books for that online. It doesn't come out till August. But this article that we're talking about by Dr. Nolan Higdon is Rallying Over Balloting, The Origins of Millennial Activism. It's published by the Journal of Critical Thought and Praxis at Iowa State University Digital Press and School of Education. We're going to conclude our conversation with Nolan Higdon after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we've been talking with Dr. Nolan Higdon. He's a lecturer of history and media studies at California State University, East Bay. He has multiple professional affiliations, including on the board of Media Freedom Foundation that oversees Project Censored. Nolan Higdon is a longtime contributor to Project Censored. He's also on the board at the Action Coalition for Media Education, smartmediaeducation.net. And the Northwest Alliance for Alternative Media and Education. He's a founding member of the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, and he is co-host of the Along the Line podcast. And you can learn more about that at projectcensored.org/ATL for Along the Line. Nolan is joined on the Along the Line podcast. That's new this year by Nicholas Bayham III, who teaches ethnic studies at Cal State East Bay. And your creative director at ATL is Jorge Ayala, and your engineer is Janice Domingo. I wanted to make sure listeners knew where to find more of Nolan Higdon's work. Of course, you can go and find the article we're talking about today. It's titled Rallying Over Balloting. It's published in the Journal of Critical Thought and Praxis. And Nolan, you have now 31 episodes of the podcast. And to segue from the topics in your study, can you, our listeners and now viewers, what are the things that you're covering on the podcast? I'm obviously setting you up this way because there's great overlap.
Yeah, absolutely. The podcast comes from the tradition of Project Censored, which is to get students involved and have faculty work with students to create things that benefit the public. And so Along the Line is a production of myself and Dr. Nicholas Bayham, who's a professor of ethnic studies at East Bay. And we work with students to produce content. And then we try and distill these complex stories into half-hour shows that come out every Friday afternoon. We cover everything. We're profiling all the 2020 candidates. We have a show coming out about Julian Assange in 2 weeks. We just covered all the false stories about Russiagate that were in the corporate media. This Friday, we have a show coming out about all the different Facebook scandals. We go through them one by one. Nick and I, we do some analysis ourselves, but for the most part, what we try and do is present what information is out there for the public so they're able to decide. We also think they're great for the classroom. Educators, we encourage it to use these shows in the classroom. They're a great primer for discussion, and it sets some boundaries on what is and is not known about certain subjects.
So, Nolan, earlier in the program, you mentioned how Colin Kaepernick's kneeling protests really did ignite a lot of activism in the millennial generation. We then saw, maybe a couple months after, Nike ran a really big ad around Colin Kaepernick and that kind of social justice message. I personally think this is kind of a mixed bag when corporations try to lean into a social justice position. I'm wondering if you could speak to that, because in some sense, it would be great if all of the giant, wealthy, resource-rich corporations were perfectly in line with the people. But at the same time, we know that this can also be co-opted for more nefarious capitalistic purposes. So I'm wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah, just a reminder to our listeners, when you were telling that story, I was thinking of when Nike used to be able to do your own custom shoes. Remember someone wanted to write sweatshop on it?
No, they wanted to put the name of the 12-year-old Vietnamese girl on the shoe, and Nike said no. That's what it was.
I would agree, Chase. I think it's a corporate co-optation of the movement. The one silver lining I would say, though, if you have a corporation feel like they have to co-opt a movement, that probably means your movement is showing some real promise. It's showing some pressure. It's showing some numbers. That doesn't mean Nike is a true ally. But think about the Pepsi commercial a couple years ago that tried to tap into Black Lives Matter. The very fact that they thought Black Lives Matter would resonate with consumers illustrates that Black Lives Matter was making a real impact. So I agree with you that it's severely problematic, and it's probably going to join or direct people in the wrong direction. But you can also look beneath the surface and show that there is true impact being made with these movements.
Right. And anecdotally, I've found that millennials, or just the public in general, looks towards athletes and their protests more than they look at, say, actors or Hollywood, when I think it used to be a little bit more reversed. So have you seen that these kind of athletes with these large platforms, you know, the LeBron James of the world, the Colin Kaepernicks, they really seem to not only have the right and the space and the platforms to speak to these issues, but it seems to be compelling to their fans as well.
Dr. Nicholas Baham, again, who I host Long Line with, he does a lot of work on this, and he argues that sports have always been one of the limited spaces where poor people in general, but poor people of color specifically, have been able to get a large platform. And so throughout history, they've used that platform. Some folks have used that platform to spread political messages, to spread a perspective. And yeah, I think you see that happening today, and social media has brought a lot of these figures even closer to the public.
So Nolan Higdon, we have about 5 minutes left before you have to take off, and then Chase Palmieri and I are going to talk for maybe 5 minutes at the end of the show, because Chase, of course, is also a millennial and an activist, and we're going to carry on the conversation to finish the show. But Nolan, before we let you go, thanks so much for taking time to rejoin us, and again, we're happy to be able to feature you today and feature your new article, Rallying Over Balloting, The Origins of Millennial Activism. It's published by the Journal of Critical Thought and Praxis at Iowa State University Digital Press and School of Education. You can learn more, too, about the podcast, the Along the Line podcast, at projectcensored.org. In the top bar, it's the ATL podcast. You can click on there. And, of course, Nolan, people can follow you on Twitter. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm at Nolan_Higdon.
NOLAN_HIGDON. So, Nolan, before we let you go, you list some things, of course, at the end of the article, and you all were mentioning math a minute ago. Make America, was it Think Harder?
Think Harder.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, the last chapter of the United States of Distraction is called Make America Think Again. And so that's definitely one of the themes that's going on here. And so what are some of the recommendations that you have at the end of your study, Nolan?
I think that there needs to be a little more research on what activism is being taught and how effective it is.
By the way, I'm sorry, I just wanted to interrupt very quickly because at the beginning of the article, you point out how your scholarly contribution is one of a few, that this is something that's newer in terms of the research, and so you're actually contributing to it on the ground level. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I would like to see educators offer more civics education. We've lost civics in our schools. So teach people how a democracy works, how voting works, how the Electoral College doesn't work, and the purpose of activism and organizing, things like that. And I also believe that educators should bring in examples of hate and harm in society into their classroom. I think one mistake a lot of educators make is we propose solutions in the classroom before we've really taught students what the problems are. And some millennials may not know. I mean, especially millennials of privilege may not be aware of things that are going on in some communities. So bringing that kind of stuff in the classroom. And then I think also using the classroom space as a way to discuss some of the different activism and guest speakers going on in society. Try and bring some of these folks in, whether it be digitally or physically, bring them into the classroom and kind of have discussions where you break down what these folks are doing. And then, you know, work with administrators on campuses to make sure that this isn't just like a 1 month program or something like that, that it's built into the curriculum and that students get access to it. And I'd say lastly, educators should introduce and allow students to work with popular culture and media in the classroom. Don't make it everything in the classroom, but don't also make it something that's ignored in the classroom. Bring it in. What are they watching? What are they listening mm-hmm. to? What messages are in those things, and how is it influencing their decision? So I think those are really critical discussions to have with students.
Well, yeah, it's also a way of both meeting them where they are on one level, and we're also learning from each other and us from them. But then it also is a useful tool for educators in terms of like, okay, now how can I refashion this theory in a way that they're going to and use their examples, right? So it's a way of reaching different audiences. I know I certainly do that in a lot of my classes. I know you've done it in yours for a long time. So it's important to know that we've been critical too. In fact, in United States of Distraction, you and I are not just critical of media, but of education. But it's not just, like you mentioned, it's not just critical for the sake of being negative. You have to understand the root of problems in order to be able to address them. In fact, the word radical or radicalism means going to the root of something. And I think that you and I hit something in that book, that there's sort of this merging of the problem, right, between a lack of a critical pedagogy in education, a lack of empathy and morality that's just not there in the curriculum. And of course, media is ever chasing the corporate. The media is ever chasing the profit, ever chasing the clickbait headline, and it's ever chasing Trump on Twitter. And those, all of those things need to be changed, and might sound funny to people, but as people in higher education, I think it's a privilege that we're in higher education. I think it's important to recognize that, you know, while there may be overarching structural problems with colleges and universities that are being corporatized and top-down managed and guided pathways and this kind of business, right, whatever the buzzword of the year is, but it's also the case that we find people on the campuses that want to do this work, just like we find the students, right? They're there. And we really need to work closely with the people that we have as allies to be able to do this. And of course, Project Censored, you know, founded in 1976, really embodies, I think, in a lot of ways, this service learning and this civic engagement and this kind of activism that lends itself so well to education. And we've got people on over 20 campuses working with us. And I know, Nolan Higdon, that that's been something that's been effective for you in the classroom as well.
Yeah, that long tradition of Project Censored I bring to my classroom, and I know a bunch of other educators do as well, that not only have students identify and understand a problem, but also identify organizations that are working on that problem. And before they leave your classroom, make them propose a solution to that problem. Solutions thinking is the way to go. You don't want them leaving your classroom depressed about the state of the world. You want to leave in the classroom being like, I can do this. I can overcome this. I can solve this. It's going to take this many people, this much time, this much effort. But really focusing on solutions, I think, is critical. I know we do that in United States of Distraction, and all the great students and faculty through Project Censored have done it for years, as well as the community members who have supported us. So I think solutions is a key part to any classroom.
And also, another place we do this is these conferences, and I know we're putting on another conference with the Union for Democratic Communications at California State East Bay, and you're one of the key point people there, having worked with UDC in the past, and of course with us at the project, and being faculty there, and a new media center that's being put together there with you and Grant Keane and Mary Carderas. So there is a conference, and the students are actually part of the conference. They're not part as spectators, as you were mentioning earlier. They're actually learning how to organize. They're part of the conference. They're part of presentations and conversations and dialogue. So if you're listening and you're interested in this, November 1, 2, and 3 will be at the California State University East Bay. That's in Hayward, California, just south of Oakland, California. So if you want to learn more about that, it's this fall. You can go to projectcensored.org, and of course, we'll all be there. The project, UDC, Nolan and I will be doing a panel too on our book, United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and what we can do about it. And Nolan Higdon, that'll be your first book formally, and you have another one in tow on the history and anatomy of fake news. So definitely going to be a busy year for us, Nolan Higdon. I want to thank you for all that you do. Anything you'd like to share, parting words with our audience?
I just want to thank Mickey Chase, the whole staff there, and our listeners. Thank you so much for supporting Project Censored Radio. It's badly needed. It's great to see that it's staying alive.
Well, Nolan Higdon, thanks so much for everything that you do, too, in support of this and critical media literacy education for social justice. Your recent article, Rallying Over Balloting, The Origins of Millennial Activism, online at the Journal of Critical Thought and Praxis at Iowa State University Digital Press and School of Education. Also, tune in to the Along the Line podcast. You can learn more at projectcensored.org. Nolan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff is executive producer and host of the program with myself, Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer, and Dennis Murphy is our associate producer in the studio with us today. The Project Censored Show airs on over 50 stations around the United States from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous archived programs, please go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast app. Feel free to share your feedback with us. And last but not least, thanks to all of you, our listeners and now viewers, for tuning in. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love with our brothers and our sisters.